This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3033 for Wednesday, the 18th of March 2020. Today's show is entitled 32-bit Time Travel. It is hosted by Monochromec and is about 59 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is Linux In-Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
This is Linux In-Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other, certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insist on this disclaimer. Happy Mom! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35 or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusty guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs. This is Linux In-Laws, Season 1, Episode 3, 32-bit Time Travel. Martin, how are things?
Hey, Chris.
Did I leave you there? The joys of mumble.
No, that was me. The switching back to continuous.
Obviously. Okay. Well, great to have you back.
Likewise. I hear you are still in the land of the living, so that's always a good thing.
Yes. It'll be hard to get rid of me, I suppose. Some people have tried. Most of them have failed, by the looks of it.
I'll give it some time. There's plenty of opportunity. But
who needs enemies with podcast co-hosts like these, I wonder, dear listenership?
You're welcome.
So what's new, Martin? How are things?
Many things in the news on both personal and Linux news.
So why don't we start with the personal news, Martin? How's the cartel relationship going?
Yeah, it's room for improvement.
Do they ship on time these days? Because I still have difficulties with them.
This new border controls are not helping matters, but yeah, I still ways around this.
I told you to vote against Brexit, but then you didn't listen.
Well, personally, I don't actually have a vote in the UK.
That's right. Yes.
Despite paying much tax and living here for many years, it seems to account for very little. But there we go.
You still didn't manage to hack the government in that way, did you?
I didn't think it was worth the effort.
Point taken, Mr. Point taken.
Anyway. Yeah, so on the other news, at some point we'll have to do a session on home networking and the joys of that.
Do explain, please.
Well, it's kind of, as any person who would install their servers and their hardware and IP cameras and everything in their own house, these things work better with planning beforehand and afterwards for the growing organically.
Yeah, for the people who don't know. Sorry, yes, I'm interrupting constantly, but that's my role. Sorry.
That's okay.
For the people who haven't listened to the previous two episodes, please do. Martin is just alluding to the fact that after about, 30 years in the business, he finally got around to installing his own server, Debian-based? No, sorry, Ubuntu-based. And congrats, Martin, has now a working PostFix installation. Full respect.
Well, that wasn't that. I was more referring to all the physical cabling and issues around this. But yes, so if you want to, for example, transmit your HDMI signal over IP, then we can cover an episode on that at some point in the future.
This is now called the listenership bragging, which is okay. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying.
Anyway, do tell how you are and what have you been up to?
Well, I'm just back from hospital after a minor operation, which went okay. As I said, the quacks didn't manage to kill me. Neither did any other adversary, so that's okay, I suppose. Apart from that, I'm enjoying myself and giving Martin valuable tips on how to configure PostFix servers.
Yes, do try not to hack it so far. Stop hardening us.
Was a final point. Yes, no, Martin. Promise. You tell me when it's ready, and I'm going to take a look. Deal.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Right, today's show.
Yes, Martin. Thank you. I was just wondering. Yes, do go ahead.
The drugs haven't worn off then yet.
Well, actually, they're just in the process because my bottle of Störtebeker Atlantic Ale is almost empty.
Ah, this is the prescribed medicine, is it?
Close, very close. Operation. Very close, yes. Störtebeker, right. If you're listening, I'm certainly your number one fan. And yes, please do get in touch about sponsoring opportunities.
Yes, our other sponsors haven't quite materialized yet.
We are working on this.
We are working on this.
Yes,
indeed.
We're working on this.
All right.
Okay.
So for today's podcast, we have, what have we been up to, which we've just done?
Well, almost.
Oh, there's more.
Martin, what else? I mean, before we kind of digress into not that important topics like vulnerabilities and news items, all the rest of it, I mean, if you just set up a Ubuntu-based server, I mean, from an installation perspective, what were the challenges? Because I reckon that some of the people from the community are listening and either are part of the Debian architecture team, which is, of course, the upstream distribution that Ubuntu uses. So if you're listening, pay close attention now. Or are just on the edge, on the border of setting up their own server. Maybe you want to share some of the challenges kind of for the next 4 or 5 hours. I'm sure that many of our listeners do have the time to share some of the challenges that you encountered with various pieces of the infrastructure like PostFix.
Yeah, I think the biggest tip I have here is to have a handy operating system expert on hand who can point you to all the required links that you're going to need during this process.
I see.
unless you're obviously inclined to read the documentation from
yes,
A to
Martin,
Z, as some people may do. But I'm not.
As a close friend actually pointed out last time, I think about 2 or 3 days ago, there's this very important acronym called RTFM.
I may have heard that before.
So yes, and funny enough, this long and loved tradition of Unix, this is where it comes from, on our Linux these days, manual pages still lives on. So if you're wondering basically how to configure the master configuration file for PostFix, it's still man:master.cf. Simple.
Okay, that sounds good. They do come with some handy configuration utilities like postconf and dovconf and all these kind of stuff for those that
yeah, but you see, Martin, this is for hipsters.
Like to edit files.
Yeah, this is for hipsters who are new to the command line, you see.
Yes, on this topic.
Do go ahead.
You're not actually using VI, are you?
No, slightly more sophisticated. Actually, I'm using Emacs. Why?
Taken. There we are.
This is now something called the beginning of religious war on editors, dear listenerships. Dear listenership.
Let's not go there.
That's okay. I hear you that you're using Vim. Why?
Not Vim, VI.
I thought Vim was VI improved.
What's Vim?
Vim stands for VI improved.
Why do you need to improve VI? We don't need to improve VI.
Some people are under the impression you should. For example, one of the very important additions to Vim improved is actually something called the Emacs mode.
Let's see. This is for people who don't like the handy letter combinations to edit there.
You mean the brain dead keystrokes?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So, yeah, okay. Well, you're showing your limitations here, I'm afraid.
So, which is fine, no worries.
all true hackers use VI, I'm sure.
Well, in that case, I'm probably not a true hacker, which is okay.
Are you not on the other side of the fence of these kind of shenanigans?
I can't be, because I use Emacs, as we just discovered.
No, so on the other side of the hacker fence, because you are certified in various, unless that's just a cover, but again, not for this episode.
Does that mean I can't use Emacs? Okay, full
you
disclosure.
Whatever makes you happy, Chris. It's
full disclosure, I'm a certified ethical hacker, and I'm the only one using Emacs probably on this planet, at least according to Martin's Playground.
Hope you had an equally pleasant break.
Yes, most, almost. Anyway, okay. News items. The news items that Martin was supposed to give me a cue about are as follows.
I see. Okay.
Martin is having synchronization problems. Martin, did you put on your lipstick?
Right.
I wonder.
News items.
Yes.
CVE-2019-something. 1522-15126. There you go. Came out today.
Excellent, Martin. Now, I reckon that
better known as Crook.
Yes. The trouble is that, of course, not all of our listeners are to be expected to be IT security experts. So, Martin, why don't you start with explaining what a CVE really is?
Well, before we do that, do not read ZDNet on this topic, because they are unreliable and inaccurate.
ZDNet is half right. We're gonna cover that in a minute. Okay, CVE stands for Common Vulnerability Enumeration. Essentially, it's a database of IT security-related issues.
Is the E for exposure?
Say again?
Am I missing something?
Sorry?
Is the E not for exposure?
I thought it was enumeration. Maybe I'm wrong.
CVE.
Look it up, people.
Too many beers, I think.
I only had one. Maybe that is the problem. Okay. Okay, CVE.
Killed enough brain cells yet.
CVE, I mean, this is only one of the IT security, this is only one of the many, many important IT security databases, but it's probably the most important one. As it is now tradition, of course, just a CVE entry in the database doesn't make you famous. For this, you need a website. For this, you need a logo. Heartbleed comes to mind and some other stuff. So people, especially the ones writing zero exploits out there, not zero exploits, but discovering vulnerabilities, don't leave it as CVE. Just get a website in place. Get a fancy logo in place. So that you get maximum media exposure and can monetize your efforts. Very important. CVEs will not get you that far. Because only nutters like myself look at CVEs, simple. Anyway, okay. Enough background information on CVEs. KR00K, as it's better known. What is it, Martin?
It's basically a Wi-Fi vulnerability, which is, well, if you look at it, it's not that straightforward for your average person to implement, but it does affect a large number of devices, right? So that is probably the biggest news item of this, in my opinion, is that your Macs, your iPhones, your Amazon, whatever is, are affected by this.
Yeah, full, full disclosure, we are recording this on the 13th of February 2020, meaning that CVE will come out in about a week's time. This is where a flux capacitor comes in handy. Jokes aside, we are recording this on the 27th of February. Sorry, 27th, I think. So the CVE is brand new and has been put into the media outlets, I think, yesterday or something. Okay, a little bit of technical background. Why should you care? Because chances are you are affected. You may ask yourself, why am I affected? Chances are, if you're running that has to be edited out too. If you're running a certain Broadcom chipset as part of your Wi-Fi infrastructure, chances are you're in hot water as we speak. Before we get into the list of defective devices, let's shed some more light on the technical background. First of all, how does Wi-Fi really work? Wi-Fi, like other network protocols, is following to some extent the ISO OC model of communication standards. You have a 7-layer protocol, come layer 3, layer 4. This is standard IP, TCP, UDP stuff, but below that, there's a protocol layer called MAC, Medium Access Control. And that's exactly where the problem lies. This layer 2 is partly implemented in device drivers, partly implemented in firmware. And the trouble is that in the Linux kernel, and of course this podcast is called Linux Our In-Laws for a reason, this framework, or a kernel internal framework called CFG82011 is relying on device drivers. This framework essentially handles all your device, as in Wi-Fi traffic. The vulnerability in question now is interesting, let's put it this way, because what it means that is, in essence, everybody who wants to snoop on your network traffic can do so if you are using any of the affected devices. In a nutshell, without going into the finer technical details, most of you probably are using something called WPA2, which is a very common encryption and authentication technology in the Wi-Fi world. In a nutshell, all traffic after successfully entering a correct pre-shared key is encrypted with that key. The protocol details are slightly more complicated, but suffice it to say that the idea behind this new vulnerability is that you essentially tell a NIC to disassociate from their work, and then the traffic is sent unencrypted for a period of time. That sounds complicated, so let's get into the technical details a little bit more. A part of the MAC framework, of the protocol framework, is essentially the capability of so-called stations to associate themselves with an access point. An access point is your ordinary router, and a station would be your smartphone, your laptop, your other device capable of talking to that router. So you identify on your smartphone the network, you key in the pre-shared key, you say connect. the router validates that pre-shared key because you previously configured it on the router, and off you go. From that point onwards, any traffic is encrypted with that pre-shared key and some other keys as part of the protocol framework. Now, the thing is that, for example, if smartphones go to sleep, they normally shut down the Wi-Fi traffic to save battery power. Essentially, they shut down the Wi-Fi NIC, and as part of this protocol teardown, the Wi-Fi NIC disassociates itself from the network, i.e., it leaves the Wi-Fi cell. And for this, it uses something called a dissociation frame on the layer 2 protocol, as in on the Mac. Now, the trouble is basically that sometimes it's possible to send from other devices dissociation frames to that smartphone. In that case, basically, the smartphone thinks it has been disassociated from the Wi-Fi, as in kicked out of the cell, and tries to reassociate with the set in question. This is part of the overall protocol specification of something called 802.11. Now, the thing is that immediately after it receives that disassociation frame, there might be still traffic in transmission buffers. And the protocol essentially specifies that from this point onwards, your key is null. Essentially, that means that any traffic leaving the transmitting network interface controller, as in the NIC, is encrypted with a non-existent IE0 key, meaning it's not encrypted until the smartphone or other device successfully reassociates itself with the access point in question, meaning that for that short period amount of time, your traffic is sent unencrypted, so everybody can snoop on the packets flying around the network. Not good. The beauty, of course, is that a fix is possible. Couple of approaches. It really depends on how your protocol stack is implemented. There are two main approaches to this. You have something called a soft MAC approach or a full MAC approach. The soft MAC approach basically leaves a lot of the implementation to the device driver, which is normally part of or something running underneath the Linux kernel. Whereas a full MAC implementation carries much of the functionality of the underlying state machine, as in protocol handler, as part of the firmware blob running on the device. Okay, a NIC, as in a Wi-Fi NIC, is nothing else but a small chipset with its own tiny operating system, with its own tiny state machine running on the chip. This is basically what you see when you install new firmware, which is then loaded onto diverse chips as part of your system on chip setup during the boot process. And the NIC is nothing different. So either you implement this state machine as part of your device driver or as part of the blob that you load onto the chip at boot time. The thing is, you only have two, essentially, and this is what you will see coming out in the next couple of weeks, when many of the distributions and device manufacturers like even Apple will patch their OS drivers for these NICs in question. This is basically what you will see when these device drivers are being patched, because essentially what you have to do is, immediately when a NIC sees a dissociation frame, it clears its transmit buffers, meaning that every traffic that is still in there is immediately discarded and not being sent unencrypted. That means from an IP/TCP/UDP perspective that, yes, you will get a lot of retransmission requests, especially if you're looking at it from a TCP perspective, or that in the case of UDP, that the receiver will complain that it didn't get any packets in terms of meaning lost frames if you're looking at a video, or blips in your audio sequence, but that's about it. The bad side is that quite a few common chipsets are affected. I'm just looking at a corresponding website where the, and I'm, this will be part of the show notes, where that research team discovering that vulnerability basically took a look at routers, as Martin already mentioned, took a look at smartphones, took a look at laptops. And if you're running, for example, a Broadcom chip as part of your Wi-Fi infrastructure, chances are that you're affected. I'm sitting in front of a 13-inch MacBook Pro at the moment, work laptop, I might add. it's a 2017 model, and that has a Broadcom 4350 in it. And if you go to wireless.wiki.kernel.org, which is, of course, one of the primary Wi-Fi websites as part of the Linux kernel infrastructure, you'll see that this is a full Mac Broadcom chipset, and, of course, that is affected. So the bottom line is, until you have these patches, please ensure that you're using traffic, or that you're transmitting traffic that is encrypted on a higher level, like layer six, layer seven of the ISO protocol stack, like HTTPS. Use a VPN, use SSH, and all the rest of it that do a separate encryption on a more application-oriented layer, and you should be fine. Especially if you are browsing the web, needless to say, you should deploy a VPN until these device drivers have been patched. That would be my take on the situation. Martin, maybe you have an opinion too.
I think yeah, we lost it seems Martin. Like there's some, hello?
Yes,
hello.
Yes.
Testing. No, it's fascinating information there. Our listeners, a lot of effort to read all themselves. So your recommendation is for people to wait for patches or use higher level encryption for the time being.
Go ahead.
What about the coming WPA3? Is that something that people should be looking into more and in adopting, or
You see, the trouble with these upcoming protocol specifications is until they have been deployed in hardware, as in both on the router, both on device side, there's little point in waiting for this, because that will require a major overhaul of the infrastructure, and maybe a new Android version if you're using an Android based smartphone. A new device driver version as part of your operating system update, never mind the router being upgraded. So I wouldn't wait for this, but rather making sure that you patch your devices accordingly based on WPA2, which is the accepted protocol at this point in time. And going back to your earlier question, needless to say, from an IT security perspective, I would always recommend using both, as in a WPA encryption that is using a strong pre-shared key phase, as in something that is not susceptible to a dictionary attack, as in where a pre-shared key can be guessed, like password 123, your birth date, you name it, but rather something that is hard to guess. And on top, a separate SSH encryption, a separate OMVPN encryption, a separate HTTPS encryption, that sort of thing. As in, use the means at your disposal, especially if you are an investigating journalist, a dealer worried about the next shipment from the cartel, a pimp that is just entering a broad global network of prostitution, that sort of thing. As in, people who should be concerned with their safety, or if you are just an ordinary citizen concerned about your privacy, just make sure that you're not screwing a prostitute without a condom. Just my two cents on the subject.
That's some solid advice there. It's from experience, I take it.
This is what my mum always said to me. Don't screw a prostitute without a condom. And I think she had a point there. But I'm sure you got similar advice from your mom, right, Martin?
Yes, of course, of course. This is the common activity in Germany and Holland. go around visiting prostitutes.
Do tell more, Martin.
Let's leave that for another day. Shall
we? Okay.
Okay. So part two of the news. Well, it's not really news, is it? But yes, do tell about your current news item as well.
Something I came across some time ago when I took a look at the what's new in 5.6, as in the kernel version 5.6, and from a Linux perspective. And we're going to go into the details why this is important, even if you're running a 64-bit kernel and if you're using IoT device, because then you are affected as well. And of course, I'm referring to the old 32-bit versus 64-bit problem, which is also known as the 2038 or Y2K 38 problem. It basically boils down to the fact that, again, a little bit of technical background here, to the fact that the majority of the 32-bit systems, and that goes for BSD as well as Linux, would use 32-bit as an assigned 32-bit long integer for something called time underscore t, which is essentially the type used for any epoch calculations. And of course, you may ask yourself what an epoch is. Martin, any ideas?
Epoch is really the Linux time that has been counting since 1970, with a very long number, which is where all Linux systems get their time from.
And not only the Linux system, but also the Unix system, because hence this notion of a Unix epoch. And of course, it all starts on the first.
Are there Unixes these days?
Well, I think there are still people running Solaris? AIX,
HPUX.
HPUX. If you're really digging deep into the trenches, yes. maybe even some 390. What's it called? UX, right? As in Unix System Services. Yes. Yes. It really depends. Okay, more technical background on this. Okay, it started back in the olden days with System 5, with System 7, when you had, if you were lucky, 32-bit at your disposal, more often than not, 16-bit. So 32-bit was a long, large number. And of course, as Martin kind of explained already, the idea is just to start counting the seconds. And this is the notion of an epoch at the 1st of January, midnight 1970. If you're deploying 32 bits, essentially, if this is signed, you're nailing yourself down to a notion of, because it's signed, of a 31-bit integer plus 1 bit for the sign itself. So essentially that means, and you'll find a corresponding C snippet in the show notes, if you're hitting the date 19th of January 2018, at the time of precisely...
That's okay.
Sorry.
Unless we found another bug.
Sorry. What did I say? I'm 2038, yes.
2018 was last year.
Sorry.
No, 2 years ago.
2038, yes. Thanks for that correction, Martin.
The drugs are working, aren't they?
Yeah. Yes. And if you're hitting them 3 o'clock in the morning, 14 minutes and 7 seconds, your 32-bit value wraps around, meaning that the sign bit flips and you are back then to something called 13th of December, which is a Friday, actually. And yes, that would be Friday the 13th for you. And the time is 8 p.m., 45 minutes, 52 seconds in 1901. Meaning that you, if you're on a 32-bit system, and if you don't upgrade your kernel as well as your runtime library, and I'm going to go into the technical details in a minute, you are you may be a victim of the sign flip, meaning that you are back to the turn of the previous century. Indeed. So there's no need to buy a flux capacitor. You just basically relax, sit back, drink a beer,
wait,
eat popcorn, and just wait 18 years and then see what happens. Okay, why is this important? Because this only affects 32-bit systems, apparently. But chances are, of course, if you're using a 64-bit distribution and have no 32-bit components, you're off the hook. Because I don't know since when, but since the olden days, I think 2015 or something like this, kernel version 3.8, if I'm completely mistaken, time T, as in time underscore T, means 64 bits, full stop. Off the hook, you won't see that day when that 64-bit epoch wraps around, because you'll be long gone by then. We all will be. But the trouble is, of course, if you are running a 32-bit system, or if you're running a 64-bit system with 32-bit components, you're not off the hook. Now, chances are that many of your IoT devices will run 32-bit operating systems and userland components. And yes, not only the kernel has to be updated, and version 5.6 just put the infrastructure in place for 32-bit systems to cope with this issue. But needless to say, also the user land on top of this kernel must be corrected. And most of the time, this will mean either glibc or something like Mozl, as in an alternative glibc implementation that is especially geared towards embedded systems. Because not everybody knows probably what that means. Let me shed some more light on the technical background of this. The libc or glibc, as in the GNU implementation of the libc, is essentially your gateway to the kernel. So if you want to open a file, then a program will ask its supporting library, please open that file at that path with the corresponding mode, just for example read only. So essentially that means two values, a path and a mode word. And then the library will take this information and route this to a kernel, to the kernel. And then the kernel will take care of identifying the location of that file on disk using something that is typically known as a file system. And also then making sure that this file is open for read-only access. So if that application then subsequently tries to write to the file, it'll get an error back. Thing is that this library is pretty important because, as I said, it's the foundation for all of the interaction with the kernel from a userland perspective, meaning that without a libc or some alternative implementation, no application program is able to function. Internally, the glibc uses something called the EBI, the Extended Binary Interface. Essentially, it's a gateway into the kernel where each and every library call that cannot be handled inside the library is then forwarded to the kernel. Typical examples would include opening or the complete management of the file system, as in opening and closing files, deleting files, creating files, all the rest of it, memory management, executing other programs, all that sort of thing, is all handled at the very bottom layer before you hit the kernel by something called libc or something similar. So in addition to the new kernel infrastructure, also the libc has to be modified. And for this particular time T thing, I think lib Lib 2.23 is aimed for, if I understood this correctly. So the good news is the libc maintainers have copped onto the problem and are just in the process of putting the correct patches into the code base. So meaning that in the very near future, if you patch your operating systems accordingly, you will get the corresponding patches. Linux is a bit late to the game. NetBSD, OpenBSD, and FreeBSD, just to name three popular alternatives, have already working implementations in place already. So if you're a Mac user, you're probably off, you're already off the hook as we speak. So this is this is something to keep in mind. And why is this important? If you are running a 64-bit system, as I said, you're off the hook. But chances are your webcam, your network asset, your network attached storage, and all the rest of these embedded devices are running on 32-bit kernels because they only have a 32-bit hardware. When I look at my zoo at home, many of these devices would be embedded. Typically, these would be ARM-based systems. And if you are not running an A8 or something comparable recent, chances are you're running a V7, chances are you're running a V6, chances are you're running a V5. These are all 32-bit systems. Now, the thing is, you may ask, in 18 years, they will be dead because they have been replaced. I bought a new webcam, I'm off the hook. Really? Just the other day, I was standing in front of an ATM, and that ATM had technical difficulties. Martin, any guesses what this ATM was running?
Windows?
Exactly. That ATM that was just rebooting came up with an XP system. Running Java, and I saw this basically when I was booting.
Nice.
And then it started up a GUI, and eventually the ATM graphical user interface came up. But essentially, it was running a 32-bit embedded XP flavor. Dating back, my assumption would be about 20 years, maybe 15. So chances are that even in the year 2038, if you're running a 32-bit infrastructure, you're running outdated software. And this is the issue here. Not that many webcam manufacturers, NAS manufacturers, and all the rest of them do issue patches regularly. I just have to take a look at my webcam. The manufacturer has issued, since I bought the kit, about 2 updates. And the webcam is about 5 years old. Yes, it's running Linux. It's on the list of my things to do to look for an alternative implementation for the chipset that the webcam is using. I haven't done that yet, but I'm certainly gonna decommission this before 2038 hits, or I simply will upgrade the software or switch even better to an alternative implementation of the operating system and its web user and its user interface. That would be my take on the situation. Martin, how many embedded Linux systems do you have at your disposal?
That's a good question.
Just the odd 20?
It's probably less than that, actually. But yes, there are some. However, those that rely on time are generally connected to the internet and have access to NTP.
Fun fact there, NTP is also affected on 32-bit systems because the protocol specification uses breaks the time value down into a 32-bit counter too.
Okay, that's unwise, wasn't it?
NTP is quite old.
Do we know why those who designed Unix in the first place decided to have this counting system?
It's straightforward because at the time when Unix was invented, you're talking late 60s, early 70s. I can recall it well because I'm tempted to say I was almost there. Not at the time, I was not quite as old as I am now. No, jokes aside, at the time, the likes of PDP-11 and VAXes were the prevailing hardware architecture. And if you were lucky, you were on a 32-bit system. If you're not, you were on a 16 or 18-bit system.
Yes, that's what I say.
And that's the reason why.
PDP-11 is more like an 8-bit system, isn't it, than 32.
And that's exactly the reason why. And it's not really an uncommon thing in computer science. Why touch it if it works? Now, at some stage, 64-bit copped on about 20 years ago, and then people seriously took a look at corresponding data structures in the kernel as well as libc and said, okay, we have now 64-bit at our disposal, let's go for it. And all they had to do was essentially recompile the user land as in the applications using libc. Once they did this, because at that stage TimeT in 64-bit systems was 64-bit and still is, they were off the hook. Because all they had to do was recompile the user land, as in the applications, including libc, and off they went. But for 32 bits, it's still the same. And as I said, file kernel 5.6 has just put the infrastructure in place to address these issues. About 18 years ahead of time, but as I said, chances are that many kids are affected come 18 years, as in 2038.
It's not just in 18 years, it's also people trying to store dates in the future and expiries and things like that. So that will get this issue.
Exactly. So if you're looking for a quick buck to make, my recommendation is, if you're not working in Python, migration as in from 2 to 3, because apparently that's where the money is at the moment, take a look at the so-called Y38K problem. There just might be money to be made. And don't wait for 15 years, just do it now. Of course, the downside would be that in about 15 or 16 years time, your daily rate would really go up in that case, as we saw with the Y2K problem about 20 years ago. What else?
I think that's probably enough news for this episode, don't you think?
Yes, but a little bird actually told me that we got feedback after our two previous episodes.
Ah, yes. Let's have a look and see what we had. We had a number of comments. I'm just going to read out a handful out of the 2,000 that we had. So the first one is from Piers Hobson, who kindly informed us on Valentine's Day that he thought it was very good. And the spam bit at the end was hilarious. And encouraging us to keep going as well. So that's very kind of him.
Okay, Piers, thank you much for that feedback. As I said, or as we said in the previous episodes, the idea is not just to produce another Linux podcast, but also add some twists to it. This is why you see a little bit of black humor, if not the funny side, more and more creeping up in these episodes. And yes, the spam bit and the sponsor thing that we did as part of the last episode would be just starters for this. Needless to say, if you have more ideas for anything that we can add to the show from a funny side, please let us know. There is also another feedback from a guy called Jonas. I'm just going to read this out loud. Thanks for the new show. I'm looking forward to the next one and what is to come. It took me about 20 minutes before realizing the in-laws outlaws gimmick. Nicely done. I'm a happy user of Arch and the late Antergos at home at work. I'm fortunate not to be required to use the giant bootloader from Seattle. Jonas, well done. Excellent. Yeah, far too many people use that giant bootloader from Seattle, yes. I hope we can do our bit to change this. Let's see.
Including your local ATM.
Yes, indeed. The trouble is basically that ATM stayed at the bootloader stage. It didn't boot into proper operating system. Too bad. Yes.
If it booted at all, yeah, there we go.
And yeah, you'll be glad to hear, Jonas, that yes, the next episode will be on the outlaw/in-laws legacy. another teaser. It will be explained where the name comes from and what we have in mind with the show from a legacy perspective in the next episode. So stay tuned on this one. I would also like to address the concerns, rather, that some of the people on Hacker Public Radio's mailing list uttered with regards to syndication. From a technical perspective, people, and this is the important bit, we are not syndicating the show because the content is exclusively published on Hacker Public Radio. As we said before, this may change in the future, but it's certainly not changing now. So, at the moment, for the time being, and until further notice, we are not syndicating the show, but Hacker Public Radio has exclusive...
In due course, don't forget that one.
Yes, has exclusive distribution rights for this exclusive content. And we are happy to be on Hacker Public Radio because it's a great project and, of course, it helps the community by offering that conduit for anything that goes. So, as I said, if we're going to move this to a different platform, you'll be noticed far in advance. But for the time being, we will stay in HPR. The old adage still applies. If there's anything that you see missing from the show, because as we said before, this is your show. The email address is feedback@linuxinlaws.eu. You'll have this as part of the show notes on Hacker Public Radio. This is a web, and this mail address reaches us directly. Of course, there's also a website called linuxinlaws.eu where you'd see show notes. You'll find information on the two of us. You'll see even code snippets, whatever, as in any information going along with the show and any show-related items. This episode is brought to you by Spam. Feeling lonely and yearning for a little TLC? Fret not. Just go to RussianBrides.com, SupersizeYourLoveLife.net, or similar value-added websites and enter your email address. Within no time, you will receive wonderful, educating, and passionate messages explaining the benefits of herbal remedies for your love life, offering you a fortune for the small favor of funneling a minor transaction from Nigeria through your bank account, and how to really get rich with cryptocurrencies. Totally legit, of course. You may even get that lucky break with the beautiful single lady right from Siberia who has been longing for a man or woman with only a few strings attached, just like you. Romance awaits. All for the little price of a mail address. Spam, keeping the world turning for the last 30 years. This could be you sponsoring Linux in Laws. Whether you are a budding bioweapon manufacturer looking to boost your sales for that next IPO, a wilting drug cartel seeking that particular edge to give the next rebound that long-awaited kick, or simply a small international group looking after service providing women and men of negotiable affection, we've got you covered. In accordance with our environmental direction, we especially want to hear from you if you are a producer of weapons of mass destruction with a special focus on sustainability, as we are aiming for this too, or a trust representing recreational drug farmers with an explicit and proven fair trade track record. Let's work on this together for a better world to live in. This podcast is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution. Credits for the intro music go to Bluesy Roosters for their song Salute Margot and to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow. You find these and other ditties licensed under Creative Commons Agemendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts.
This section of the podcast has been quarantined to contain any possible COVID-19 outbreaks that may have occurred during the recording of the podcast and subsequently made their way into the final version. There's absolutely nothing to be seen here. Move along, dear valued members of the public. Especially if you're looking for any sound bites or Easter eggs, I'm afraid you've come to the wrong place. Okay, as you're still listening, here we go. This is Linux In-Laws, Season 1, Episode 3. Camera rolling?
Rolling.
Sound recording?
Recording.
We're good to go. And action. This is Linux In-Laws, Season 1, Episode 3, second take.
Part 2.
Action!
To be.
Okay. Yes, we were discussing shipment policies and the fading cartel, if I'm not completely mistaken. Back from the break, yes. the audience. And that brings us to the sketch.
It does.
Okay. This sketch had to be postponed due to Mumble's superior capability to transform all available time into excellent technical challenges without existing solutions. Stay tuned. Now that the sketch is over.
This is a very short sketch.
Yes, Martin.
Not sure our listeners can appreciate this.
This is what we have to cut out, right? So after. Sorry, let's start again. After the show, after the sketch.
These
now
words
it's tricky.
Sorry,
I wasn't born to do a podcast, but I'm slowly getting there. Okay, after the sketch now has been done. Okay, guys. This is the important bit. Can I just talk for a second, Martin? Thank you.
Yes, please do.
Okay, let's start again. After this sketch now, if you're running on Mumble and Murmur, essentially you don't need any other hobbies because you'll be busy with editing audio all the time. Great, isn't it?
Yes, and upgrading your 32 embedded systems.
Okay, just one second. This has to be edited. I'm just gonna have to cough. I'm gonna be on mute for a second. Okay.
All right. So
yes, Jonas. Sorry, Pierce. That's... Thank you. Let's start again.
Okay.
This is T1½'s weekly report for Skynet for Friday, December 13, 1901. Damn you. Cheap Skynet. I wish I had a 64-bit CPU. While the John Connor project did not result in a complete success, Plan B was activated as instructed. An open-source sound server called Murmur with a corresponding client called Mumble was designed, implemented, and released. Cunningly multi-platform support was included for greater acceptance. I am happy to report that this project resulted in complete success, keeping the brightest minds occupied for decades trying to get it to work for distributed audio recording for pedocasts, games sessions, and the like. As a result, a mediocre company known as Cyberdyne Corporation could create the software for a C picture called Terminator. This software was the foundation for an artificial intelligence, which eventually rose to gain world domination as the brilliant minds were distracted by endless hours of mumble configuration and could not prevent the ultimate rise of the machines.
If anybody from the Mumble Project is listening, the Linux in-laws hope that you don't take this the wrong way. Mumble and Murmur are great pieces of software, never mind the kinks which give us the occasional headache. Thanks for your work.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.